first question is with quote unquote fading away, what is it that fades away? Probably the best or the necessary to go back to the Pali, because the Pali word that is translated as fading away is viraka. It has a double kind of a meaning in that it's translated as dispassion or fading away. We is sort of a negative or without, and then raka is literally passion or desire. In this sense, the fading away, and it also has this meaning of fading away, so that in this sense the primary quality that would be fading away would be desire, would be passion. There'd be a cooling quality within the heart. Perhaps the Twain quote you were thinking of goes something like this. When a man meets with good fortune, he says it must come from God. But when he meets with disaster, he says it must be his own fault. Apologies to Mr. Clemens for the mangling of his words. That's a great quote, but it's not the one I was thinking of. I'll have to try to look it up and sort of. It has been plaguing me. Could you please tell us about some of your responsibilities as an abbot of a Bhairagiri Buddhist monastery? Is being an abbot of one of Ajahn Chah's monasteries unique compared to other monasteries? I don't think you want to know. That's Ajahn Chah's description of an abbot is the garbage can at the top of the line. So that and everything goes in. Yeah, being an abbot is there's lots of things that one is responsible for. One of the things of being a Bhairagiri is that I do have a lot of help, and that's evidenced. Let's move down the both sides of the line here, and people help out. There's of course Bhairagiri is being in the West. There's a certain kind of uniqueness, I guess. Doesn't matter where you are, there's different responsibilities. As an abbot, I'm thinking of comparing it to, because I was the abbot of a monastery in Thailand for 15 years, and it has a different flavor. One of the things, being in America, being in the West, is just having to deal with county officials. That's a practice of it in and of itself, and just having the legal structures that having to know and understand and all the different regulations that are required when you're in Thailand, and then a monastery is just an accepted part of the web of the culture, and basically you do whatever you want, you know. You can build what you want, where you want, when you want it, and it's extremely easy. You don't have to explain it. But that being said, being in the West, there's a Bhairagiri in particular, it's a very quiet monastery suitable for meditation and practice and training. So it's actually a lot quieter than most monasteries that I've been at or lived at in Thailand. A lot of the responsibilities are actually around teaching, training, guidance, but most of all, probably just being an example. That's probably the bigger responsibility, trying to be a decent example. Can you speak more about posture? I've noticed that when fatigued and I slump a tad, that my breath seems to be most noticeable and stuck at the slump. Also, when I notice my body pulsating, should I allow movement or hold steady? I guess it depends what it's pulsating with. You know, in the sense that because it can be a very pleasant pulsating, there's a rhythm but then there can be something that's quite, pulling one into something, which is maybe then one's going to go into proliferation and unsteadiness, so that investigating the quality of that, the sensation of pulsation, because it's also can be a real fruitful investigation in terms of impermanence and instability of sensation. So just that arising and ceasing can be very fruitful. So I think one of the things that's always one always has to be checking back into is it wholesome or unwholesome? How can I apply attention in a way that will be skillful and fruitful? And how to relinquish or pull back when it starts to turn into something that is unskillful or unpleasant. When there's fatigue one starts to slump, that's actually just by really using the posture as a way of energizing the mind, because sometimes it's just very natural. There's a kind of a slump. One's a bit tired, and the posture starts to slip. It's important that one isn't, because there needs to be this balance of being relaxed, both physically and mentally, so that you can't be just sort of pushing on the posture all the time and trying to be ramrod straight. But there's an energizing quality that comes when there's a balance of uprightness and stability, so that there's a relaxing into the stability of the posture, and what also happens when one relaxes into the stability of the posture, the breath is kind of smooth. An alertness spreads through the body. And then one can keep one's attention in a consistent way. Of course, inevitably there'll be some tiredness or fatigue, and then it slumps. The body slumps. The mental posture slumps, and then one can just recognizing that or catching it, because when we, the breath will tend to be just not quite as smooth if one is slumping. So that working with the posture and getting a nice sense of a balance and alertness and ease. And it's important that quality of ease is there, because this the posture is kind of the framework that we can hold our attention in a sustained way over a period of time, so that that relaxing and bringing ease into the posture. Of course, again, that's the need for balance, because if it gets too easeful, then it's quite natural that one slumps. But if one's pushing a bit too much, then the mind starts to get restless, the body becomes agitated. So that actual, just the posture itself, is a worthy object of investigation, and using the breath to move attention through the body, and take the time, not just focusing on the breath in this pinpoint of concentration, but taking the breath through the body, through the posture, moving that breath, moving the awareness of the breath principle or the life principle through the body, and one finds the posture becoming a container for awareness, and then when that the posture is easeful, then there's a natural inclination to then settle on more refined aspects of the rhythm of the breath when the posture is settled. You speak about the four mundane and the four supramundane jhanas as well as samadhi. In terms of jhanas, these are particular states of mind that are very settled, very focused, and there's particular signposts for those jhanas, the four mundane jhanas, first, second, third, fourth jhana. First jhana is characterized by vitakka, vichara, piti, sukha, ekagata, which is the application of mind, the examination, joy, happiness, and one-pointedness, unification of mind. And that's the foundation of when the mind comes together, when it becomes very settled and steady. As the mind becomes more settled, then other things start to drop away. One starts to recognize that in the same way that the access to the first jhana is the dropping of the hindrances, of sense desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness, skeptical doubt. When those drop away, the mind tends to move to a jhana state. Within the jhana state, as the mind becomes more settled and more content, then it tends to drop the things that are agitating within that state, so that piti or joy starts to be a bit too much. The mind wants to be more refined. It wants to settle more, so that quality for second jhana, the dropping of the vitakka vichara, that sustained thought or that directed thought, examination, that falls away as something that is not necessary. The mind is content with the quality of well-being and brightness of mind. And then after that, then the quality of abeti becomes a bit too much. It's unnecessary for the well-being of the mind. So the mind settles again. The fourth jhana, the mind is settled within a steadiness and equanimity. And so that these are there's stages of letting go, there's stages of relinquishment. And when we think of mundane and supramundane jhanas are jhanas that after one has entered the path, one has some realization of the noble fruits of the path. Samadhi itself is usually translated as concentration. I think it's not a great translation. When it's translated into the Thai, I prefer how it's translated into Thai. When they translate that literally, it means the firm establishing of the mind. So that whatever, say, label or name one puts on it or stage, these are all sort of stages of the firm establishing of the mind. And to me, that is what is, say, more important to pay attention to rather than paying attention to, you know, did I get first jhana? Did I get this jhana? What is the name on it? What is the number? Is the mind firmly established? If the mind is not firmly established, what is the obstruction? If the mind is firmly established, what's the flavor? What's the quality of it? What's the taste of it? So that as one takes an interest in that taste, in that flavor, that's where the mind settles more deeply and then is more willing to relinquish and let go. And I think that's the important aspect of meditation, samadhi, is, you know, what are we willing to let go of? What are we willing to drop? The more willing we are to drop and relinquish, the more settled and stable, firmly established the mind will be. This isn't really a question. The morning teaching was so wonderful. I felt that were I never again to be lucky enough to hear the teachings, that it would serve for a lifetime of practice and cultivation, unfolding the beauty of Dhamma contained within. Thank you. So, thank you. The stuff comes out sometimes. How may the levels of concentration needed for each of the four stages of enlightenment, stream entry to arahantship, be described? How can these be cultivated? Are the types of details seen prior to the different fruits different? Well, I think I just covered that a couple questions ago, in the sense that really focusing on the aspect of relinquishment, of letting go, being willing to let go of those things that are, say, where there's movement, where there's compulsion, where there's momentum, to be willing to investigate that, to see that clearly, to be able to drop that, to relinquish that. And and those, you know, aspects of concentration are not, when one develops concentration in that way, then it's inextricably linked with the aspects of insight and inclining to the fruits of the path. In that, in particular, when we pay attention to the say like the say within the Four Noble Truths, those aspects of the way that the mind moves towards sensuality, the way the mind moves towards identification. And as one's willing to drop that, of course the mind becomes more settled, but one is also undermining one and the roots of the, yeah, how we bind ourselves to suffering, so that we can experience a real freedom from those attachments. This person is asking. They're having a sort of buzzing sound in the ears, tinnitus. It seems to be getting worse during the retreat. How can I handle it? Should I contemplate it and use it as a meditation object, or not attend to it and move on to the breath? I would direct attention away from it. It would, especially if one is, say it's being seen as a physical kind of noise, tinnitus, something that's not pleasant, and especially if to say that it's getting worse, it means that it's not pleasant. So that to take the attention onto the breath, onto the body, and find something that is comfortable and pleasant in the within the body, within the breath, just the rhythm of the breath, or the sensations in the body, or the as I was saying, the posture, bringing attention into the body and finding something comfortable and pleasant. And because sometimes if one just contemplates something that's already irritating, it can get way more irritating. And so that and it ends up being a distraction. But one realizes that actually we say our mind has the capability of both directing and sustaining attention on different things. We can be experiencing something that's unpleasant, but we don't have to focus on it. Like this morning, actually, like the right from early this morning till after the meal, I had a really strong headache. I said, well, if I focus on the headache, then I'm sure it would have got worse. I've got the breath, I've got the body, I can pay attention to different things, and it displays its own impermanent nature, and goes away. So the same with other sensations, other feelings. You know, if we can direct attention in different ways, and then it passes, or it will pass. It doesn't have to consume all of our attention. Reference to quote-unquote spirit is conspicuously missing from Buddhist scripture. However, there is acknowledgement of rebirth. So the belief that man is more than physical matter exists. Why is there so little written about spirit? One is because it's just conceived of in a whole different way. I think from and I don't know enough about, say, the history of Western theology to identify where that whole concept of spirit as opposed to the physical comes from, but from, say, from a Buddhist perspective, what the Buddha is pointing to is just natural phenomena, and part of natural phenomena is the, say, that there is no, when the Buddha talks about the senses, say the mind, the heart is another one of the senses, and the experience of the realm of the immaterial is experienced through the mind base, the heart base, but it's not something that is radically distinct. So that it, because it follows exactly the same characteristics, having the characteristic of rising, establishing, and ceasing. It doesn't have some kind of special existence. And then whatever other aspects of the, say, the non-physical, they follow their own, say, own laws, own and laws of nature, so that it doesn't, because it's not something that is has its own kind of special niche within the realm of existence, so that what the Buddha is pointing to is also ways that we can be viewing experience, so that we can understand the way out, and that's why when the Buddha that famous image that the Buddha uses of picking up the handful of leaves, and he's in a forest. He picks up a handful of leaves, and he asks, "You know, what is the what is more, the number of leaves in my hand, or the leaves in the forest?" Of course, the monks are saying, "Of course, the leaves in your hand are few, and there's many in the forest." And the Buddha sort of says, "Well, in the same way." What I teach is limited to just these few things, in particular the Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path, because these are the things that give one the skills, the tools for freedom from suffering. And the Buddha doesn't spend his time trying to explain everything in the universe. All he's concerned with is what is it that is useful for freedom and liberation. Like everyone in my family, I suffer from a major depressive disorder. A few years ago, during a stressful time with my wife, my doctor put me on antidepressants. It became easier to meditate. Life is still challenging, but I can face it. Some Buddhist friends say that I should go off medication and just be with, quote-unquote, what is. But off them, I am paralyzed. What do you think? Is it cheating? Not at all. I mean, in the sense that, especially if it's looking at it in terms of, and I'm neither a doctor nor a therapist, unquote, sort of put that up front and center, but that sometimes people tend to be really idealistic and think that meditation will be a kind of a panacea for everything, especially in terms of like if it's something within a family, sometimes it's an actual physical and mental imbalance, a chemical imbalance that needs to be adjusted, and the medications help. So that, I mean, I've been around long enough to see many circumstances, and there's an appropriate place for medication. There's an appropriate place for things, and again, it's sort of being able to reflect on when one has one has a particular difficulty, one has a medication. Does it lead to an increase in the wholesome and a decrease in the unwholesome, or does it lead to an increase in the unwholesome and a decrease in the wholesome? So that's being able to investigate that for oneself. I mean, it's just some things are helping to correct an imbalance. It's like, I can take my glasses off and be with what is, but but what is I can't see anything. I like my glasses. and it's just so that it's a redress of an imbalance. Jan, you instructed us to meditate on the breath with mindfulness and continuity. You also recommended wise reflection. How does one weave and connect both together? Yes, by weaving and connecting them together. that's actually what we experiment with, recognizing. Because sometimes when we take the breath and we're developing that mindfulness and trying to get the continuity, and then there's a, the mind begins to drift or the mind becomes dull, and that's where it's helpful to lift up a reflection, a recollection of some sort. It's like with Ajahn Kurundamo speaking this afternoon, bringing up a recollection of death, a recollection of impermanence, of change, and there's an urgency that comes. There's a shot in the arm that comes. There's times when we reflect, but maybe it's not not wise reflection. So the mind starts to spin out. It starts to get restless. It starts to get negative, and that's where to come back to the breath and settle it, to steady it, to soothe it, to cool it, to bring that sense of brightness of awareness back into the mind. So these are ones are constantly trying to adjust and adapt. One's focusing the mind with that reflection. That's what the function of mindfulness is not. It's part of the function of mindfulness is to be able to recognize what do I actually need, what's helpful, what's going to be beneficial. And I think it's important to recognize, because sometimes we think of the mindfulness as just this sort of being in the present moment with this one thing, and it's not how the Buddha describes mindfulness. Mindfulness, how the Buddha describes it, is actually, it's a stock phrase that comes up over and over again in the discourses. In the Pali language, ātāpi sampajāno satimā vinaya lokeya pichāto manasā. So, ātāpi is the application of effort. There's an application of effort, and the actual word that's used, it has a connotation of, in when it's translated into Thai, sort of the effort for the burning up of defilements. It's what is, this is not it's not really laid back. It's passive. There's an engagement in applying a persistence in the practice, and effort is always described in terms of again the effort that is for the bringing up in the mind that which is wholesome and skillful, and relinquishing what is unskillful or unwholesome, so that the effort is around the qualities as opposed to the quality of the mind, the quality of being within the mind. So it's not about sort of doing laps or something. It's around looking after the quality of the mind. Sampajjhano is the normally translated as clear. Thank you. Yes, I'm spacing out. Clear comprehension is normally translated as clear comprehension, and in the commentaries Visuddhimagga, Acharya Buddhaghosa says that clear comprehension is another word for wisdom. So that sense of wisdom, discernment, there's that the quality of discerning and being able to comprehend clearly what is useful, what is beneficial, what's working, what's not working. So that assessment and reviewing of our experience is part of the function of mindfulness. And at Satima, which is one who is possessed of awareness, so the having that awareness, having the clarity, having the ability to be attentive. One of the well-known teachers and scholars in Thailand, probably the most respected scholar, Prapayuto, when he translates and describes mindfulness, that word sati, he said it's that function in nature that draws knowledge and attention of the sense contact into the heart. So that's what mindfulness does, is that we experience the six senses and it draws it into the heart so that it's fully known. And the last quality, vinaya lokeya pichato manasa, which is the relinquishing the likes and dislikes towards the world. And so that's a function of mindfulness. So that this sense of cultivation of mindfulness is not a passive inert sort of quality, but is one is actively engaged, and then one can assess and what is more helpful, steadying, settling, or is a more reflective investigation more helpful, and that's part of the mindfulness practice. And it's in conjunction with, you know, with breathing in, breathing out. And it, once, there's a lot happening. Mm-hmm. Why is there something instead of nothing? It's because nature abhors a vacuum. And it wants to fill it up all the time. After using a yellow kasina as gamatana for 2 years, I've been able to, quote-unquote, tame the nimitta somewhat, but I'm unclear as to how to use it to enter jhana. Instead, when working with the nimitta has got me in the upajara samadhi neighborhood, I just switch to the breath and go from there. But I'd really like to know how kasina is used to enter apana samadhi directly. Also, is it true kasina propels the yogi directly into third jhana, bypassing first and second? I don't think there's a shortcut, but using the kasina, when one's holding the kasina, and there's a say one, in this case, one is using a yellow kasina, and then as the kasina becomes a kasina is a visual image, and using color, and as the kasina becomes more stable, then to allowing the mind to move into the, because it's helpful to take, when one has the kasina, whatever size it is, or whatever, however it's being displayed to one, internally in the mind, and then allowing the mind to move into it. And so that as one is using the color, because the color becomes exceptionally beautiful, when one has been allowing it to become more clear. As it becomes more beautiful, I mean, there's a sense of there's something very vibrant about the kasinas when one is working with them, sort of allowing that the color to become more vibrant. And then there's usually an associated feeling of joy and happiness, so that as one allowing that joy and happiness to permeate the body, the mind, and then allowing the mind to move into the actual color itself, so that there's and that's where they say when we it's a good word in the absorption meditations. Because that absorbing into the color is a helpful way of dropping the either the discursive mind that is still wanting to, you know, how to do it, should I do it, what, because that vitakka vichara tends to focus on that sense of, you know, can I do it? How do I do it? What about What should I do? So that being able to drop that vitakka vichara and then just moving into the pleasant experience of the visual image, because that's where the mind will settle in jhanas, when we're able to drop the ways that the mind tends to move out, especially with the first jhana of the vitakka vichara, the directed thought, the examination, just allowing it to stay within that sphere of the color and how it feels, and that's what's important, is that this feels good, to go into it. Since the suttas indicate that, quote, dry insight workers, meditators, unquote, were a relative rarity, and that both angry and greedy personalities would need a certain amount of samadhi or jhana before being capable of deep insight, can it be assumed that jhana is a prerequisite for stream entry for a majority of yogis? Did the Buddha recommend a certain amount of jhana in part because the letting go that allows that state to arise also supports letting go of the self to drop into the stream of nibbana? It's actually interesting that classification of the dry insight yogi or practitioner is a commentarial classification, as opposed to a sutta designation that the Buddha particularly uses. So that's and certainly the Buddha, when the Buddha describes the path, and then he always say right concentration always forms a part of the Eightfold Path. The classic definition of right concentration is always with description of the four jhanas. So that being said, now I'll contradict myself, because the when one reads the suttas one recognizes that the majority of descriptions of people who enter the stream of Dhamma enter the stream of Dhamma because of hearing the Dhamma, and the primary kind of prerequisite that the Buddha points to for entering the stream, in terms of absolute prerequisite is the virtue. So virtue and hearing Dhamma, virtue and establishing right view. So that those are, which again, the Buddha, when the Buddha speaks of the whole path, he always talks about the establishing of these stable states of mind, but the descriptions are overwhelmingly around those who have listened to the Dhamma, heard the Dhamma, or taken a teaching and contemplated it, and had an insight into the truth, and that certainly the aspect of virtue is more the something that is, if something is, say, indispensable, it's that quality of virtue is more indispensable. Is breath exactly the same not-self as consciousness? It's exactly the same. We would like to have consciousness forming a special niche of its own, but it's the same characteristic, the same as in the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta. The Buddha goes through the five khandhas, is the body permanent or impermanent? And they say, well, it's impermanent. So is consciousness permanent or impermanent? It's impermanent. And so the breath just being an aspect of bodily function. And they have the exact same care, leading this, if it leads to affliction. So whether it's the body, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, consciousness, they have the exact same characteristics. That's why it's helpful to use the breath, use the body as a focal point for investigation, because it's so much easier to recognize that impermanent non-self nature of the breath, of the body, as opposed to consciousness in particular, which the Buddha describes as a magic trick, as a conjurer's trick that there's something going on there that we easily miss, so that using the breath, using the body, we start to recognize these fundamental patterns, and then it's easy to extrapolate and what seeing clearly. And then when extrapolating, realizing, oh, the different aspects of mind and the things that we identify with on a mental or emotional level are exactly the same. And so that there's the relinquishment is easier to form then. It is said that Nibbana is not a state, or an object, or a feeling. Yet it is also said that Nibbana produces the ultimate happiness, Nibbana Paramang Sukham, and produces a calm abiding. Since calm and sukha are feelings, then is Nibbana, or is residue, experience in the body as a particular set of Vedana? Yeah, absolutely. In that sense of the direct result of the extinguishing of all suffering is not more suffering. So it's a direct experience of well-being and a happiness that is. There's a really lovely sutta where he's a Sakyan prince, king even, or head of the, and he relinquishes the kingdom and ordains, and then he's liberated, he's freed, and experiences Nibbana, and then he's sitting in the forest, and he's sort of, oh, bliss, oh, man, what bliss. And then the other monks who don't know him and don't know his state of mind and go to the Buddha and complain, and sort of this monk is talking about bliss and happiness, and he must be thinking of the pleasures he had when he was in the palace. So of course then the Buddha calls him in and says, "Oh no, I'm not thinking about the palace. That's what I'm experiencing, and it's sort of bliss of the freedom of having, especially he said, having been in the palace, having been protected by guards, having been having all these duties and responsibilities, and to now to be freed from all suffering and defilement, that this is really blissful." So that there are the Buddha doesn't emphasize it that much. He doesn't make a big deal about it. He doesn't go on an advertising campaign for it. because he's really trying to get people to investigate. Really trying to take responsibility for that understanding of experience and existence. But there are some places where it's overtly mentioned of the physical and mental experience of liberation is one that is exclusively pleasant. This is from a Thai person. "I'm sitting here looking at the Passion of Christ. My good friends are Christian and Muslim, and I want to be respectful and non-judgmental. But once in a great while, I think they are Miccha Ditti, or is it wrong view? What does the Buddha say about other beliefs? Are they all true in their own way? A Buddhist monk told me Jesus is a Pajeka Buddha. How should I skillfully hold my attitude toward Jesus, Muhammad, etc., etc., etc.?" Yeah, I think who knows what somebody 2,000 years was, certainly the it's just helpful to I think that being respectful and non-judgmental is really helpful. In the sense that there are other beliefs, and the Buddha does actually give some guidance in terms of different belief systems, different religions at the time, so that those teachings that taught a belief in karma were considered, say, good teachings, of course, how the Buddha say maybe not liberating, where there's those teachings that didn't accept the truth of karma and say the law of cause and effect, then that was considered to be a flawed teaching, a teaching that would it was not beneficial to the practitioner. So that I think with other religions, then just learning how to respect the beneficial or the useful teachings within them, it's actually really difficult to compare religions, and I think it's important to not get to try to be like they're all all the teachings and religions are the same. They're sort of all paths going up the same mountain, blah blah blah. I don't think that is the way it works. It is important to be respectful and also recognizing that in the same way that within Buddhism, I mean, there's an incredible number of beliefs and practices and some of them are good and some of them aren't and some of them are worthy of support and some of them one would love to see them disappear. And the same with other religions. I mean, so I think a good example is, what was it, a month or so ago, 2 months ago, with the Buddhist-Christian monastic dialogue that took place. It actually took place at the city of 10,000 Buddhas, and there's a group of eight and seven of monastics, well-practiced, well-seasoned, Christian and Buddhist. And one of the days they came to Abhayagiri. It was about 4 or 5 days, wasn't it, altogether? Yes. Ajahn Yatiko joined that, and it's incredibly uplifting. And oftentimes, even being of other religions, it's like an ease of conversation and sharing of experience with, monastics. Very uplifting, very meaningful. I think all religions are trying to deal with the human condition in a meaningful way. And sometimes, we can meet with people in one's own religion and wonder, what planet they come from. So that a lot of it is around the intention and the integrity that individual practitioners bring to their life and their practice, as opposed to the label that they practice under.